Hello, and welcome to this, another episode of Frame and Reference. I'm your host, Kenny McMillan, and you're listening to episode 101 with Igel Berold, the DP of Extrapolations and The Machine and No Hard Feelings. Enjoy.
You've been busy as hell recently, haven't you?
Well, I have been busy for the last couple of years. I mean, obviously now I'm not so busy because for obvious reasons, because nothing much is happening. But I've been busy. I've been doing, I did Extrapolations, which I did, I think, November 2 years ago. So it was in the pipeline for a bit because of all the special effects and I had to shoot 8 episodes. Then I had The Machine come out, but we actually shot like way back in Serbia, I think in 20, but it's set in Russia. We didn't shoot in Russia, so it was actually scheduled to be released right around the Ukraine, the invasion. So they did it, and probably rightly so. So that's been stuck in the pipeline for a little bit as well. And then I have another movie coming out actually in November that I'm really looking forward to. It's called The Holdovers with Alexander Payne, which is a movie set in the early 70s in a boarding school in New England, which is a brilliant movie. It's like all these movies is, but I'm really looking forward to that one.
Yeah, and did you do No Hard Feelings as well?
Yeah, then I did No Hard Feelings. Yeah. Which, oddly enough, was actually the last film I did. Of all the above movies, it was the last one I did and the first one to come out. I mean, that was the craziest turnaround. We actually I think I did DI on it like 2 weeks ago. Before that, we did some reshoots. Like just before the strike was, early May or late April or something. So that was, so it has been a bit full on the last couple of years. So to be honest, I don't mind sort of being at home in solidarity with the writers.
Yeah. There was, I heard a joke that was kind of, it was, I think a grip posted it, but he was like, something along the lines of like, oh, everyone's really going to appreciate my sacrifice when this is all over, like just sitting at home doing nothing.
Well, the one thing I do want to say, which is I mean, this is tongue in cheek, but all the writers, they may be on strike, but we all know they're sitting at home coming up with great stories and writing scripts, and they're gonna have a big pile of scripts at the end of this. Whereas everybody else, I mean, like me and the grips and the electricians and whatever, We can't do anything, so I encourage them to write a fuckload of scripts so we can when it gets resolved and we can get busy again.
Yeah,
I really need it.
Yeah, well, they're striking against working for studios, not striking against writing, you know. And like any of us, you know, I'm sure when you wander around, you still want to take photos, even if you're not shooting.
True. No, I love writers. I'm married to a writer. She doesn't write movies, but then I have a lot of writer friends. So yeah, it's all good. I mean, actually, I remember this feeling from back at in the COVID days when there was no work at all, but it was actually, other than the fact that there was a pandemic going on, it was everybody was sort of, you couldn't do anything about it. So you had to sort of let go, and you weren't worried about, oh, this guy is shooting this thing, or wish I'd done that, or whatever, because there wasn't anything going on. So I sort of enjoyed that. I mean, I love the pandemic. It's the best thing that happened. No, but it's a little bit the same now. So. And luckily it's the summertime, and so I'm kind of I'm happy, because I'm not, I think like all freelancers, I'm not always good at, you know, saying no. I preach saying no, but I'm happy with everything I've done, but sometimes, you know, it's hard for me to say no.
I'm currently in that situation. It started and I'm so used to just saying yes to everything because I've never had my schedule pile up. And then starting at the beginning of February, towards like the end of February, I was like, wow, there's a lot going on. And then, went an extra month and I was like, shit, I'm like not getting good sleep. And then, April rolls around and like, I should have said no to some things. It's just been compounded, but it is. Everyone keeps going, oh, it's nice you're working. And I'm like, yeah, but I would like to read or something at some point, do something else.
Exactly. I mean, there has to be more to life. And also, sometimes in the past when I've said no to things, other things have happened and I've been really happy with that. So, who knows how it's all wired.
Yeah, certainly a luxury to be able to say no to things, but right. It is. It's when you get, I was talking to another DP about this, where it's kind of like you work really hard doing like everyone's jobs and really, chicken with your head cut off kind of thing. And then when you finally get to a certain level of production, everyone does those jobs for you. So now it's like easier, like you work your way towards harder and harder jobs. And then suddenly out of nowhere, everything's easier because other people are handling it and you get to focus on your one thing.
True. Yeah, no, that's very true. But I gotta say, I'm 50 something now and I've been at it since I was early 20s at least. But every time I leave a job, I'm still scared. I think I'll never work again. And
right.
Maybe this disaster and I'll be blacklisted. And a lot of people have it like that. But I think that feeds into the whole thing. Then you have a script or whatever, you have something and you think, oh, maybe I should do it, maybe I'll just squeeze one more in there. It's like the bank robber syndrome, right. the last heist and then all will be well.
Yeah, then off to the beach. You started off as a documentary guy, right?
I wanted to do documentaries when when I was in my teens. I was really into lots of sort of both sort of travel documentary but also Errol Morris, which was a little bit later, but like The Thin Blue Line was a real revelation for me in the way that it mixes sort of a documentary story, but in a super stylized way. And you always, it sort of really showed in a very beautiful and smart way how documentary isn't really reality. Documentary is a style of filmmaking and obviously it's a subjective I think that was a really breakthrough in my mind in a way, because I was very sort of I wanted to sort of save the world and I wanted to travel around and show all the hardships and whatever, and I wasn't that sort of interested in. I didn't really understand cinema because I'm from a family of academics, so I would watch movies, but I had no idea how they were made and it seemed like such a alien world or whatever. And I thought it was a little sort of, it was just stuff people made up in a way. I was sort of Puritan thinking, oh, documentary is the sort of pure form and it's sort of But then I went to film school I got into a film college in Wales, Newport, Wales, when I was 18. It was kind of by accident that I stumbled across it. And partly I went there because they had a documentary photography course as well that one of my friends was attending. And it was a Magnum photographer called David Hearn. He ran this workshop and the college was organized so you could, you could do their classes, or you could do film and video production. You could sort of move around, so I was still really into that. But then there was a brilliant cinema in a chapter of cinema in Cardiff, where I was staying, which is very close by.
Doctor,
and I started watching all these. You know it?
No, but I know they shoot Doctor Who out there.
Oh, exactly. But then I started watching all these sort of weird, it was like super art house. I liked it a lot. David Cronenberg and Kieslowski and all of this stuff that really, and then I started understanding, oh, people, this is affecting me. And this is as true as any documentary. And then I started sort of getting more into that. But I still, I mean, also I love to travel and I do and I did get make to make some more traditional documentaries, but also the one that sort of got me going, which was a dream come true, was a documentary in quotation marks. It was called Wisconsin Death Trip, which I did with the director James Marsh, which was like a super low budget documentary that we did all over Wisconsin. And we did all these reenactments of, it's based on a book where, that sort of took newspaper cuttings from the turn of the 19th century, and these beautiful photographs that were shot around the Black River Falls. And they sort of put there was a big economic crisis, and people were sort of committing suicide by eating cigar butts and drowning their kids and taking cocaine. Yeah, it was mayhem. But we brought some of those photos back to life, so it wasn't really a documentary, but there was a documentary element to it as well. So, but that was, I mean, it was very ambitious, incredibly low budget. We did it over four seasons, but that was such a, I mean, that was one of my sort of really happy moments, because we were so low budget that we had to make everything up literally on, like, with the, you know, with duct tape, and we had a crew of two. We had a gaffer and a grip, and the grip was the stunt man as well. And we had a producer, and that was basically it. But people were so helpful to us. They would, you know, travel halfway across Wisconsin just to stand in the snow and get shot, and then put their clothes back on and drive back home. Amazing.
Yeah, because that makes sense that you kind of like got formed by that, at least from what I can see. I rewatched Wizard of Lies the other day, and that similar kind of maybe thought, not a documentary, but a dramatized reality. But everything in your work seems so natural in a way that is still, I hate the word cinematic, but still cinematic, but very natural. And I was wondering, does that come from, is that informed in any way by, you know, the doc influence, or did you kind of happen upon that, or is that just like something that you enjoyed and kind of folded into your own work?
No, I think 100%. I mean, I think one of the things you sort of have to learn in documentary is if you shoot something that's happening, then you only get one shot at it. So you better, you know, put the camera, you know, put yourself with the camera in the right place in the room, so you can basically sort of show the dynamic or have the effect you want. But obviously you have to be sort of practical about it. So I've always been very sort of Puritan. I don't love over coverage. I'm really sort of striving for sort of simplicity because I have this idea that in order to create something complex, you have to sort of start with the simple, and you have to build it from simple. You can't start, if you start with chaos, it's very hard to sort of decipher that and turn it into and give it any sort of shape. So I think definitely that's sort of part of it. It could also be that I'm from Scandinavia, and sort of Scandinavia design is a lot about functionality and things has to be sort of beautiful and elegant, but at the same time, it really has to sort of there's no sort of fluff or whatever. It's all, it's sort of to the point in a way. But with Wizard of Lies, I mean, a lot of that is Barry Levinson as well, because I mean, Barry Levinson, I mean, he's a true anarchist, and he's very playful, and he kind of, I mean, we did a lot of stuff Wizard of Lies where we didn't rehearse, and like there's a big scene when De Niro Madoff comes into this big ballroom, and he meets all these different people. And we didn't rehearse it. We just set up a bunch of cameras, and then we sort of thought, well, if we put the chairs in this sort of way, then he's probably going to go this way, and the camera's over there, so he's probably going to be attracted to the cameras.
Interesting.
And because Barry doesn't like to he doesn't go on tech scouts either. He likes to keep it sort of lively and playful. He doesn't ever want to do the same move twice. He just wants to get into it, and then he sort of wants to hold the attention. So you sort of have to have a little bit a documentary sensibility, but then obviously you sort of you set it up as fiction, and then you execute a sort of a documentary style, which I find very sort of inspiring, because also I can doubt myself very easily. If I think too much about it, then I gotta have a sort of element of, I mean, I try and do that like when I did Deep Water with Adrian Lyne, a lot of that was sort of designed. I had a really good first AD as well, Doc Torres, who I worked with a couple of times, and he's very aware of sort of weather and the sun and how it moves, and we were shooting that whole house a little bit like a stage as well, so we had to be very sort of focused on, you know, okay, can shoot here in the morning, if the light isn't right, then we can go and shoot the scene in the bedroom, and it was a chamber piece, so it made it sort of a lot easier in that sense, but because, I mean, at the end of the day as well, there's only like, if you shoot outside, there's only so much you can do on
right
in terms of control. You sort of have to have it planned out, and unless you want to just sort of turn everything into a tent and then it all have soft light, which I don't particularly like, then you have to sort of work with the tools you have or what you're given in a way, or what you can get, and then obviously augment from there. I mean, one of the most beautiful things that now I'm rambling, but one of the most beautiful movies that was really inspiring to me was it's a very obvious one, but Days of Heaven.
Sure.
Which was obviously done with no lights at all. I mean, apparently they spend most time turning the lights off because the gaffers would still set up lights and they would have to. But I think that's, I mean, to create that sort of quality, something that is so unique and beautiful and impossible to do in this day and age.
Do you kind of have like a go-to, especially the interview I did yesterday, we talked about this, but do you kind of have like a go-to system for shaping available light? Are you just kind of like a big negative fill guy, a little bit of bounce, or do you kind of have maybe a trick you've learned from the past couple more naturalist films like that?
I mean, I think the most important thing is obviously picking a good location, and then I'm not super happy about sort of softening the lights, because I think it very easily, because you can soften the background and then you sort of create this. And the other, I mean, and I also like to move the camera, so I don't like too big, you know, too much. So I try and sort of, use some, shoot the wide shots at the right time of day, obviously, and then when you move in, then try and shape it with some negative I mean, on Holdovers, we had a big. Which unfortunately is the first scene of the movie, and there's a big scene, a long dialogue scene. It's comedy, so obviously there's a lot of different takes or whatever. And we picked a location. It took a long time to find this location, and it was perfect. It was facing north, so the house would always be backlit. It would be, I mean, it would have had its challenges as well, but we lost it due to some neighbors, like literally the Friday before, and had to fall back in this other house that was facing east, which is a real nightmare, because you're going to shoot there for a full day and you're basically going to get blasted, you're going to get sidelighted, you're going to be in shadow. And I mean, the scene works and all of that, but it's not my proudest moment. I was kicking myself and I really, I mean, I had to use diffusion. I had to do all the, you know, a lot of grading, and it was also shot late in the year, and it was a summer movie, and the sun starts setting, and that was a real nightmare. But luckily, the scene is funny, so I hope I say I served the movie.
Yeah, you got to kind of roll with the punches in that regard.
Exactly.
You had mentioned that, not to jump back too far, but you had mentioned in Wizard of Lies that, you know, it's very Doc style, but still, you know, kind of natural looking. How did that experience compare to House of Cards, which I assume was very controlled?
House of Cards, yeah, was super controlled. I mean, everything was shot two cameras. The rule was no steadicam, no handheld. It was working with Fincher. I mean, you know, because I did the first two episodes with him, and he was obviously there for the whole first season. He was sort of lurking in the shadows.
Of which there are many. The man loves the shadow.
Exactly. He's kind of easy to work with in the sense that that he doesn't, there's no bullshit with him. He knows every department, he knows everything. He was Don Bird, his production designer, helped design him. So everything was very meticulous, and the sets we built, we created these ceilings where we could do soft ambient from above, but not just sort of overall, but we could turn it on and off in sections, and this was before LED. So we did a lot of tests, you know, how to get good quality of light. We tried Kino flows, we tried tungsten, gel tungsten. We also wanted to be able to change the color temperature, so we like gel them different ways or whatever. And ultimately, we ended up doing it with this sort of patches of with the fluorescent tubes, because then we could do a mix of sort of like three tungsten tubes and one blue tube or whatever. Also, they obviously don't emit a lot of light, and we were shooting there a lot. So I mean, the producer were very happy we did it that way, because even just the air conditioning, if we'd shot with tungsten lights, I mean, that would have cost like 10 grand a day or something crazy just to, right, to cool the place down in diesel. So it was very sort of thorough, and the sort of the template in terms of lenses. I mean, we used pretty much always the 35, you know, we would do two shots. We would do like a pretty wide, a very limited sort of range of focal lengths. And he's a minimalist. I mean, if anything, I mean, he had this rule. One thing we spent a lot of time doing was figuring out how to sort of condense our equipment as much as possible. Because his theory was, you know, all the camera equipment and the dollies, both dollies, have to fit into a Sprinter van, and the Sprinter van has to be able to park right outside the location. And then basically everything has to be sort of, you just have to open it, take it, and, you know, we have the base plate on. We had customized all the cases. All the accessories were sitting on. We didn't put in individual boxes. So there was like a 15-minute rule. You have to be able to roll in, put the camera on, and then shoot in 15 minutes. And we would pick the locations where there would be some sort of ambient light. And that was sort of sometimes obviously we modified it, like we were shooting the DC Metro. We'd drawn down, I think is the whole thing is lit with two single Kino flow tubes. But what did take a lot of time was the gaffer had to go there like five or six times. So he would go down there with a color meter, he would do a reading. We would have him change all the bulbs, but they still had different color temperatures. So he had to go back there, color meter him, gel him, take a photo, come back. And then, I mean, that went on forever. But But so it's a good example of something that sort of it on the day it didn't really take a lot, but the preparation had been pretty immense and involved both what is called now the FTA or whatever, and the electricians and unions. I mean, it was a bit of an undertaking, so that was sort of the shape of working with him, that sort of methodology, and he's not afraid of the dark, obviously, but I don't think it's ever sort of you always sort of see what you need to see. It's never like scary because you can't see anything or whatever. It's sort of, unless it's like, you know, unless that's a point, but I learned so much from doing that, and also obviously trying to sort of implement all of those ideas for the next. I did the first 11 episodes, so with lots of different directors and sensibilities, and that was the real challenge, because everybody knows that Fincher could do. I mean, he could do the sound, he could do, you know, right. He could light this everything, so the real test is when he's not there. Is it going to look completely different? But I think his idea was that he wanted one person to shoot the whole thing, which was grueling because you have to prep and shoot, and we shot like for real crazy hours. But he had this he called it photon vision, I think, or whatever. So he wanted one person to sort of carry through all the way. So he didn't want. Obviously, we had more time to do episode one and two, but he wanted the same sort of. He wanted the whole thing to play as one movie, because that was also obviously the revolutionary thing, was that they dumped the whole season,
right?
And the idea was you can watch it from episode one through 13, yeah, or whatever. And
that was one of the first ones that Netflix did like that, huh?
It was totally the first one.
Right. I forgot about that.
And it really informed everything. So that's why it had to play in that sense as one piece. I think everybody should do that, because I think it's, I hate that, waiting for Sunday or whatever, or all that nonsense. I mean, that's from another era.
Right. Yeah. That's so great. I forgot how instrumental House of Cards was in like launching the Netflix model, like their current model. So congrats on that.
I mean, I should have bought shares back then, but I didn't. I had insider knowledge and that's why I have to work so hard now still.
Right. You could have been on the beach. What?
Exactly.
I am actually, now that you brought up some things that I was thinking about, because I guess there's like three questions about this show now that I think about it. That ambience you're talking about, I saw, I think it was a behind the scenes photo of The Social Network, and I'm wondering if this is what you're talking about for the ambience. Did the sets have basically instead of a ceiling, just a thing of diffusion that you were putting light into?
Yeah, it had one big sort of diffusion, but not right away up to the wall. So there was a sort of a soffit all the way around, just so we didn't get too much contamination on the walls. And then the grips did like these. They actually did negative, positive. So we did white boxes. Basically, I think they were maybe like 3 feet by 3 feet. So above the grid. There were sort of all these sort of almost shafts, and then we had to light up another sort of probably 6 feet or whatever. So it was like super soft, but we could always keep it. We could sort of turn it off, you know, in the corner, or we could keep it. Most of the time we would keep it sort of lit behind people and just give them a little bit of sort of skull sort of definition. And that was part, because it was almost like that sort of ambience was sort of it was called it was like the shadow light in a way. It was just sort of just registering and just giving almost this little bit sort of sinister, sort of Gordon Willis sort of type light, but at a way lower intensity, and then the key light would usually, you know, be motivated from practicals or windows or just be sort of a little bit of shape in the, but it, I think the beauty of it, it sort of worked with the camera style as well, because it really, you had to sort of kind of focus, you know, you could always see the eyes, but you really had to sort of open your eyes and lean in a little bit and then be like, you know, what's really going on here? And it's the same thing with the camera, because we moved the camera almost like sort of robotically. We wouldn't follow the axis. It would be like, okay, the camera starts moving and then it stops and it had to work then with the axis sort of timing wise. And that was sort of the dance between the camera and the axis. And then it would be very still. So you would almost like frozen. So if somebody just, you know, moved their finger, you really notice it, because there wasn't anything else moving.
Right.
So it's the same sort of hypnotic, sort of feeling where it's kind of sucks you in, which I think is what he does so well and so masterfully. And also in terms of continuity, that's why he likes to use multiple cameras, because it always feels like real time. It's like, you know, sometimes you see scenes and it's like, you know, it's not 100% real time. It's like, oh, I just skipped a little bit or whatever. It doesn't really matter. It's like here and there and somebody said this and that, but I think in all his work, it really feels like if a scene is 1 minute, that it there was the real 1 minute where it happened. So he's like incredibly conscientious about, you know, even the tiniest thing in the background, and that's how he used VFX as well. I mean, to a great degree is I mean, his everything he does is packed with VFX, but it's like little things that you would never know that keeps that sort of catches the sort of the moment by the throat and doesn't let go.
Yeah, that hyper continuity is something I've definitely tried to start being conscious of myself, but it's certainly hard. Plus, I heard he, like, you know, you can use the same techniques to, I wouldn't necessarily call it VFX, but like, you know, getting rid of maybe a light stand or having the boom pole operator just be able to sit right here and you're like, yeah, we'll cut that out. Like, you're good.
100%. I mean, they ended up not to, I mean, in the later seasons, they wouldn't even, like, because he would stabilize everything. He doesn't care about shaking. He can stabilize. We would just overshoot everything anyway. So we would, you know, shoot the whole ship and the image we were looking for, which cropped, but it meant we could always sort of readjust it a little bit. And the framing just, I mean, I went through quite a few I operated with Charlie Libin on the first two seasons as well, because I love to operate.
Best job on set?
That is the best job on set, and you're right in the middle of it. So if something, you know, you always know what's going on. You're not, you know, stuck behind a monitor somewhere and something happens and you're like, what the fuck's going on? But when he wasn't directing, then I thought, well, I have to sort of be Fincher here, because know what the other camera is doing as well, because it really has to. I mean, we did a lot with Fincher. We did all this crazy thing. We would shoot it like wide open, and it would be like someone was shooting a trailer park, and this guy had to open the door and step in, and it was like depth of field is like nothing. And I had a really good focus puller, Boot Shelton. But every time, I mean, like a lot of the takes, it was out, but Fincher would always be, you know, quarter inch deeper, you know, half shallow or whatever. And it was basically, there's no way you could, you know, scientifically sort of do it. I mean, you basically just had to keep going until you got it enough times and the performance and everything. But I think we shot a little more, a little less wide open when he left, because didn't want to be the crazy person torturing the director and say, you know, we need 10 more shots. But we created all these. I mean, okay, I go rambling again. Gary J eventually came in, who was the most amazing operator. He's worked with Michael Mann, and he's done all this amazing stuff, and we worked out these really sort of more and more crazy rules, because doing something like that, it felt like, you know, like you are so almost at war or whatever. It's like, because we fought so hard for it. So I remember when Carl Franklin came in and we were setting up this scene, and it's someone bound to go, two people in a bed, one goes to the bedroom or whatever. And he was like, oh, so we could pan across. And we were just looking at him like crazy people, like bloodshot eyes, and we don't pan on this show, you know? And like, so the rule was the dolly would do everything. So when we track in, you know, it would boom up or whatever. So basically Gary would fold his arms and then he'll be ready. And then we didn't like, we didn't boom or we didn't pan or tilt like almost at all, I think. But he was like looking at us and thinking, the fuck, I mean, what other crazy rules do you guys have? I mean, are they allowed to say their lines or? we kind of worked it out in the end, but Gary sadly passed away. I mean, he also did. I mean, yeah, no, he was an incredible guy, and he actually ended up doing the whole all the seasons, and I think he really sort of kept it together. I'm basing.
Yeah, sorry to hear that. You know, you had mentioned, about like the DC Metro, how it was, you just kind of went in there and did some color metering and set up a few tubes. But what's the key then to getting that look? Is that a lot of DI that's kind of bringing that together? Or is there something kind of more specific that you have to do to be able to work so efficiently and still get, that specific look?
I mean, we did a lot of testing. I mean, we tested a lot of lenses and whatever, and we ended up using master primes, and then but we didn't actually have a DIT on that show. And Fincher's, and this was a bit of a revelation, because it was obviously shot on red, and his sort of methodology was always, if you can see it on the monitor, you can get it, you know. So whatever happened, even if the monitor is set weirdly, well, that's just your grading on top of everything. So what you see is what you get. So I would kind of I would light off the monitor, and then I mean, I think most of the sort of, there was a lot of grading involved at the end, but I think more to sort of keep sort of consistency. I think I didn't actually do it because I was shooting at the same time, and Fincher did it remotely, so he would, but it's not far from what we actually what we shot as well. Yeah. And it was the first location we scouted. I remember. I mean, I was really nervous. We came down there, and obviously we'd been in prep or whatever, and we were talking about they were gonna sit next to each other, and then I was like, because I wasn't quite fully understanding. So I said, are they back to back, like classic sort of spy, British spy, whatever? And Fincher looked at me, and he was like, I can't remember what he said or whatever. But then afterwards, the producer Melfi said to me, "You just saved him a shot there, because he would have had to turn around or whatever." You know, I think that was the only time I sort of
earned your paycheck.
Yeah, exactly. No, the good thing about him is that he doesn't ever, you know, he doesn't play games and all. He's all about the project, and it's all give and take, and if somebody has a good idea, then He's gonna run with him, run with it. He's so well prepared and he so hardworking that he's usually gonna be like way ahead of everybody else. So you really have to sort of have to be laser focused to come up with something that isn't just, you know, like a random idea or whatever, which in all honesty, this was obviously for me, but it was a good random idea. But other than that, so we knew all the camera positions, we sort of drawn it up, we could sneak. He really likes to get the tube. He likes the vertical tubes. I mean, he really got me on that, got me into that as well. It was
like vertical, like Asteras, basically.
Yeah, basically old time. This was in the Kino Flow days.
Right.
So we would do like a really gelled down like a lot. We would get it in as a liner basically, and it's one of the things that he really that we talked a lot about. And I think God, I'm terrible now, what's the name of the DP that does all these that used to do Cronenworth?
Oh, Cronenworth. I interviewed him.
You did?
Yeah.
But I mean, he's amazing. But his dad obviously was also a DP that Fincher knew, Jordan exactly, and he was the one who'd gotten him onto this. You know, remember the liner, and so I think
by liner you mean like scratch light.
Yeah, so it's just a very, very faint sort of outline. It has to be super faint because otherwise it looks like you've been doing blue screen or whatever.
Right.
But we never used still light. So it was basically very often it was like if we get that line in, so we get separation. And then we just get enough light in, you know, reflection in the eyes, then that's kind of it.
Work. It's fascinating to hear how, because a question I ask of a lot of DPs is like, especially the ones who work in television, is like, how are you able to work so efficiently and still maintain high quality results? And it's fascinating to hear all the different methods. But heavy pre-production does seem to be one of the larger answers, you know, no matter what you're lighting.
No, yeah, 100%. I mean, but then the trouble came when, because then I would be shooting like literally, I mean, sometimes one director in particular would shoot like 15, 17 hour days. And then, so there was very limited time to prep the next episodes. So that made it. But I think the key on it, because one of the things I think that Fincher was really worried about going into, I think he felt there's a lot of eyes on him because obviously he's known for doing a lot of takes. He told me in the beginning of Social Network, he did 99 takes, but he would have done more, but he just didn't want to get known and missed the 100. But it's like, how is Fincher going to shoot, you know, on a TV schedule with so many takes? But the key was really the use of two cameras and even on the shows on the episodes after hours, I was like very adamant that we would always, unless it was an insert, we would always use two cameras and quite a length.
They were stacked, right?
Well, it was stacked for sort of coverage, but even in wide shots, the other mat box would always be on the edge of the other camera because we would do like elaborate tracking shots with two cameras. And we would always shoot the scene from the beginning to the end. We didn't sort of do, maybe we did pickups or whatever, but we didn't shoot like this part of the scene and then this part of the scene. We would shoot sort of as much as possible. So it always took quite a bit of time to set it up. But then when we shot it, we covered so much ground and things sort of fell into place. Also, I mean, I gotta say, I mean, the cast was, Kevin Spacey, I mean, in terms of sort of technical ability, and I mean, he's
Sure.
He's obviously great. He is a great actor, but he's super technical as well, and he'll make anything work. And very often, I mean, this goes back to what we started talking about with the documentary. But I remember we doing one scene when he's basically getting Russo drunk in the car so he can gas him. And we were like, oh, it's just a big scene, it's a turning point in the whole season or whatever. And so we're gonna spend the whole day here. We're gonna, shoot two cameras here, two cameras there, two cameras there. We had this huge big plan. But then we set it up on green screen, but actually with LEDs. This was the first time I used sort of moving LEDs. And then we set the two cameras up sort of facing Kevin first, but Russo sort of was turned away, obviously also because the camera was there, and we did a bunch of takes on those two setups, and it's kind of felt like whatever we do now is just going to be weak, and it's not going to be, so that was it basically, and we were like, we talked to Kevin, and Kevin was, I mean, we were working grueling hours. I keep saying that, but we really did. And he was like, "Yeah, fine. Of course we have it." So obviously, where you put the camera sort of shapes things as well, and it makes it fall into place. And that's sort of the Puritan thing in a way, is that I often fight on set with the sort of not fight with the first ADs or whatever, but there's all these methodologies. Oh, let's do something easy to get the day going, and it looks like we got off the bat 20 minutes in or whatever, or let's do something just random. And I'm always like, we got to do the best shot, the most obvious and strongest angle first, because everything is automatically going to shape around around that setup, and it's going to fall into place, and all of a sudden, more likely than not, we're going to realize, oh, we actually just need a couple of little pieces here, and oh, maybe it's fun if we do this, I think that's important. Usually there is times obviously where you have to start in that, on close-ups for performance reasons or whatever, they could be right. All sorts of things. But whenever that happens, I think it may be good for the performance. But in terms of the sort of cinematic shape of the scene, it's not really. You could obviously make it work, but it's not as desirable unless you work fully from storyboards, where you storyboard everything. Which I know a lot of people do, but try that once, but it scares me a little bit.
Sure. I interviewed Matthew Jensen a couple days ago, and I actually watched your episode of Extrapolations and then started talking to him about it. He's like, I shot one and two. And I was like, I fucked up and meant to talk to Eigel. That show looks so natural and pretty, and it's a brutal episode, like emotionally, and really well done there. But what we're kind of, House of Cards wasn't super long ago, but it's 8 years now, something like that. What have you learned, and what has changed up until now, in the execution of doing Extrapolations? Did you carry any of those lessons over? Are you like a completely different person now?
No, well, I mean, 100%. I mean, I think House of Cards completely changed my sort of, changed me in so many different ways, also in terms of sort of confidence and sort of being better at all the different levels of lighting that you can sort of have all that shaping and, within one stop, just at the toe at the very darkest end, but then you can have another shape, a little in the mid-tones, and you can have another shape in the highlights, and that, which obviously can become very complex and time-consuming, and it's not over. I mean, it is actually a lot easier, or not easier, but it's less involved nowadays because of LED technology, basically, because it's so consumer-friendly. But I mean, I carried that with me in everything I've done, even if it's something that looks completely different, you know, has a different tonality and the. But Ocean's I Eight. Think for Ocean's Eight, exactly. I mean, yeah. That was very different. That's a very different film. But I always try to, because I don't want to be complacent. So I always try and, you know, do as many different things as possible. But I think you learn lessons from everything. You know, there's the Barry Levinson playfulness. Then there's sort of the sort of mad scientist David Fincher. There's so many different. Sort of approaches and they all have their sort of they're all valid and with extrapolations I'm you Scott because we did the report
great film love that movie
no it was great which was that was actually one of the movies where we had to start in close because I think we shot the whole movie in 21 days so we had to, it was insane it was super low budget so the idea was we're going to start with the coverage and then we're going to work our way back out. And then when it's like, oh, time's up, then we're going to have to move on and go to the next scene or the next location or whatever. It was a...
And that's not a short film either. That's a fast clip.
I mean, yeah, it was brutal. It was brutal. But the cast, they don't really set, you know, it's not like we had to do a lot of takes or whatever. It's not like we had to... it was with a first AD Alex Finch, who I work with a lot, and he's also a great first AD and very sort of passionate and devoted to and knowledgeable and but way back like in I did another movie with Scott, his first movie called Coup 239, I think it is, was based in plutonium, which is that we shot in Romania, set in Russia, shot in Romania with Oscar Isaac and Paddy Considine, which is a good film. So we've known it either for a long time, and he'd been, I think this was the third episode that we were shooting. So he'd been in this. Like the world that Matt Jensen had also been in with like super like full on sci-fi sort of and a lot of you know VFX left right and center but we both sort of knew this is a different one in a way it's much more internal so we came up with this idea that was sort of the reference was a Rosetta by the Den brothers which is a Belgian film, which is, it's all done handheld and it basically just follows this girl around wherever she goes. Everything is essentially either, it's a point of view or it's a close up or it's an over the shoulder. I mean, that's kind of it. Everything is sort of experienced from within that. So that was the first sort of thing we thought, okay, that's the way, that's a rule, and also Scott is very structured, and obviously he's very he has a great imagination and everything, but he likes sort of dogmas in a way. So that's how we sort of structured everything, and also how we try to block the scenes. And it sounds easy, like, oh, you just do that. But obviously it means you have to block scenes in a certain way. You have to make sure your locations can sort of accommodate that. And then I think in terms of the lighting, I mean, the episode is set in London, which sort of is obviously it's in the future and it's hot, but it's still humid and it's sort of down. I thought, you know, there's not a lot of electricity. So we did a lot of sort of, where the light would chase people. So you walk in and the light would turn on and then when you leave, it would turn off. Sort of thought of sort of energy saving. And then for What's his name again now? The main character. It's Ezra.
Ezra. Yeah, yeah. Shit. Oh, Ezra. It was right there. Yeah. Ezra.
Ezra. So, but we did a lot of sort of very sort of, it was almost low contrast lighting because that was, because he was in a way sort of almost dissolving and you know, obviously his mind is vanishing. So it's a little bit, it was like a ghost story or he's not sort of very clearly defined. It's almost like, you know, it's all in the shades of grays and the, and then in certain scenes, like when he's is a little more defined when he's what's her name? His love interest,
right?
His one of his clients, and he's a little more defined. But it was sort of a very obvious way of showing him sort of turning into dust in a way.
Yeah, it's a very affecting episode.
I mean, I read all the episodes and I was doing the, I just done, I think I'd been in Serbia shooting the machine or whatever, but I was very happy that we got to do that one. It was really, and it was such a, it was always a relief for Scott because he'd been in this sort of, VFX and all of a sudden it became more playful and with the handheld and more improvised as well, and we had some VFX stuff that we had to sort of help along. But I mean, nowadays they can make everything work. I mean, it's like they always say, you know, don't move the camera and then you sort of wither away, and in the end you just, you know, run around, shoot a handheld and they make it work. So
yeah. Well, with Ezra's apartment, obviously it's pretty barren and sparse, but the lighting and the texture in the love interest, not Lola, but the other one, her apartment is beautiful. I mean, production design really knocked it out of the park with her apartment. But if I'm remembering correctly, there's like a giant window, I guess, but it's all diffuse. So you got this really nice automatic key on everything, which is really pretty.
I mean, we were shooting there in the beginning, and I was so happy. It was one of the first. It was a location actually in Brooklyn, and
that's a real location.
It's a real location.
Oh yeah. Wow!
But and it kind of it very much had the same sort of vibe. I mean, like the guy who lives there is basically like an artist who lives there and he has some stuff. And obviously they changed some stuff as well. And it was that was the same thing. It was on the fifth floor or whatever. So it was up quite high, but the windows were dirty and old. It was old glass. So they were naturally diffused and we could just, at night, we could just glow it a little bit from the street. And then during the day, we just had to be mindful because it was a corner that, you know, when we shot and didn't shoot. But I mean, that was the same thing again. I mean, very, very minimal lighting and all about when you shoot and obviously where you put the camera and which obviously also means that your director have to be on board because it, you know, like with anything, if you all of a sudden turn around and it could look like a completely different movie and we, I mean, we didn't have a lot of I mean, this was obviously television as well, so I guess we had to do 6 minutes a day or something crazy, and I can't remember if we had 10 days or maybe 10 or 12 or whatever, but I mean, that seems to be what you get given nowadays, which is not a lot. Yeah. Did you shoot? Are you a DP as well?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I should have mentioned that. I am also a DP. Right now, I'm mostly doing corporate stuff, especially. I don't get too many narrative gigs. I'm working towards that. But for the longest time, it was corporate stuff, music videos. You know, every once in a while, you get a document. And I said. Yeah, and it's a great, like, especially the corporate stuff, it's a great training ground for, like, really good, you know, basic, you know, lighting a face, you know, an interview is, and making that more, you know, the client that I'm thinking of right now, his, apparently his entire company, because it's like a massive company, they're always like, how the fuck did you do that? Why does it look like a movie? And I'm like, all right, good. We're getting there. We're getting, you know, I was the second unit DP, on, the last Bruce Willis film. So that was a step in the right direction, but I never met Bruce. Yeah. I worked with Jack Kilmer the whole time. Who's really cool. Really like Jack. We're kind of coming up on time, but we'll have to have you back on, cause you got five other projects I want to talk about. But,
it's fun. I was saying to my son, cause we're going to go and get pizzas, and I said, it's not going to take an hour, but you got me fired up with the, you let me ramble. Maybe you regret it now.
No, trust me. So here's the conceit about this podcast is it was a pandemic project I started 3 years ago because I wanted to be really make sure of my skills when time came to go shoot again. You know, so I like was investing a lot in education and stuff. And I was like, oh, I write for this website. I could use their name to like get good interviews. And I did a test episode with my neighbor who's this dude named Johnny Durango, very good DP, and bunch of PR companies were just like, yeah, we'd like to get our DP on your show. And so it's really just been me, you know, the conceit is that I'll ask questions like, oh, some people would like to know. It's like I just want to know. But I will say that this might be you don't have to answer this, but because you just shot The Machine, I would be remiss if I didn't ask if you had any good Mark Hamill stories.
Mark Hamill? Oh, okay. I mean, he's fantastic. I mean, I'm sure I have some, but we were shooting in Serbia, and it was a pretty crazy shoot as well. I mean, Bird likes to party, and he's obviously, I mean, he has so much passion, and he's such full of energy or whatever. And but the dynamic between the two, because Mark has this way of sort of bringing. Bring him down to earth a little bit, which this is a very, very great dynamic. But I have to think about it because I don't want to embarrass anybody.
Well, yeah,
enough embarrassing stuff going on in Serbia, you know.
Sure. We'll have you think about that, and then when you come back, we can chat about that. And also, once I get to see the film, because it's at the time of this recording, it's not out yet. Comes out in July. It's coming out in July.
I think that the Machine is out now. No hard.
Oh, is it? Shit.
No hard feelings. Yeah, but we should also talk about, you know, a fun one to look forward to is The Holdovers, because it's not only set in 1970 or 71, but we wanted it not to be like window dressing. We wanted it to actually make it look like it was actually made, and then someone found it, and you know, as here's a cool film from. And that goes to even sort of it's in mono, you know, sound is in mono. There's the loudest noise a gunshot can only be, I can't remember what it is, but like 32 decibel or whatever. So we were really, obviously we had to cheat to a certain degree to get that effect, but it was very challenging in the way that it wasn't like, you know, are we just gonna smother it with something that makes us, you know, like looking back like a memory of what it was. We wanted it to be like, okay, this movie was made back then, and we just kept it from you for 50 years, and there it is.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that, especially because I had read that you're like a big fan of like the energy of the 60s and 70s films. So I'm sure you put a lot into it.
100%. I mean, I mean, 70s, I think, is in many ways the sort of golden age of cinema, and
70s and 90s. 70s and 90s. I don't know what was in the water,
I agree. But sometimes, I mean, yeah, the 80s, I mean, obviously, a lot of stuff happened in the 80s, but I think a lot of terrible things happened in the 80s. But But I think, I mean, it's the counterculture or whatever, or whatever, however you want to explain it. But it also led to this sort of liberation, like with the Dogma films in Denmark with Lars von Trier, his whole setup, where it's like, you know, fuck the man, you know, I don't need money, I don't need guns, I don't need VFX, you know, we're just gonna go and do it. And I think that had a great effect.
Yeah,
mostly.
Those were important films in film school. But yeah, I would also love to talk about it. I'll definitely see The Machine and No Hard Feelings when it comes out, and then we can do the holdover as well. But I'll let you go get pizza, man. I don't want to hold you any longer than you need. Thanks for taking the time so late in the day for you.
Much appreciated, man. It was a pleasure.
Frame and Reference is an Owlbot production. It's produced and edited by me, Kenny McMillan, and distributed by Pro Video Coalition. As this is an independently funded podcast, we rely on support from listeners like you. So if you'd like to help, you can go to buymeacoffee.com/frameandrefpod. We really appreciate your support, and as always, thanks for listening.